at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. I'm with Naomi Shihab Nye. And let's have a little reading now. Give us a handful.
Cross that line. Paul Robeson stood on the northern border of the USA and sang into Canada, where a vast audience sat on chairs waiting to hear him. He sang into Canada. His voice left the USA when his body was not allowed to cross that line. Remind us again, brave friend. What countries may we sing into? What lines should we all be crossing? What songs arrive from elsewhere to deepen our days? I was haunted by that story about Robeson singing on the border when he couldn't go out of the country. I respect his work. Here's one called Living with Mistakes. They won't wear boots. They march ahead of us into our rooms, dripping. Give them a chair. Where they sit, the fabric will be wet for days. We have to talk about everything else in their presence. The Many Hats of William Yale. I love odd collections, cookie jars, light bulbs, toothpaste tubes, the man who gathered sugar packets for 37 years. So when I heard about the hats made from rinds of lemons and limes a century ago, decorated with bits of frill and cloth to represent the tribes and occupations of the time, I loved William Yale, this strange gift for his Jerusalem bride. I sent my Boston friends to see the hats. They got lost driving there in a wild rainstorm, more lost coming home. But they reported the hats, made by children's hands, lined up teeny tiny, displayed on thimbles and walnuts, were withered only a bit around the edges, as any rind might be after so long. And they felt hypnotized. A sudden, tangy hopefulness rose up from the hats, a stunning wish for women and men with tinier heads to solve Jerusalem's troubles. That's an actual collection that exists in Boston, and they bring it out once a year, and I think it's on display for a month, and I hope that someday I'll get to see it, but till now it's been something great I only heard about on the internet.
They should frame your poem next to the
collection. Well, they want me to send them a tape of myself reading it, and I'm going to do that because I sent them the poem. And I need to send them the tape. But I am very intrigued by that. Doesn't it sound like a great collection? Again, so weird. Who would take the time to make hats out of lemon rinds?
Well, there is a great display here if you had more time to go to the Smithsonian, of a man who made a great altar, a whole room full of altar surfaces out of tinfoil, little balls of tinfoil that he collected his whole life off the streets.
It's here?
It is here in
oh,
the American History
Museum.
You have to.
Oh.
And the whole thing is a testament to God, and it's got pillars and spirals and alcoves, and it's all made of little balls of tinfoil he collected.
How wonderful.
Oh.
It's great.
It is holy. Do your neighbors think you're just a regular person? Or do they know you're a poet?
They know I'm a poet, and they tease me sometimes, or they'll see something in the newspaper, or, you know, we'll talk about funny things, or I'll leave little poems stuck to their doors sometimes.
So you double as a person.
I think I'm a little mysterious to them, too. I have a great neighborhood. I live downtown in the historic Mexican-American neighborhood in San Antonio downtown. We have 100-year-old houses and the river right behind us, and cranes come for the winter and stay in the river. It's a beautiful place to live. We're very happy neighbors in our neighborhood.
The name of the program is The Poet and the Poem. We're at the Library of Congress, and we'll move farther and further with another poem.
This is about the libraries of my childhood in St. Louis and my first neighborhood there. Because of libraries, we can say these things. She is holding the book close to her body, carrying it home on the cracked sidewalk, down the tangled hill. If a dog runs at her again, she will use the book as a shield. She looked hard among the long lines of books to find this one. When they start talking about money, when the day contains such long and hot places, she will go inside. An orange bed is waiting, story without corners. She will have two families. They will eat at different hours. She is carrying a book past the fire station and the five and dime. What this town has not given her, the book will provide. A sheep, a wilderness of new solutions. The book has already lived through its troubles. The book has a calm cover, a straight spine. When the steppe returns to itself as the best place for sitting, and the old men up and down the street are latching their clippers, she will not be alone. She will have a book to open and open and open. Her life starts here. Well, of course, the little tricky thing about that ending is her life keeps starting every time she reads a book, as so many of our lives do. We start over in new ways, new understandings, new perspectives.
I wondered, I forgot where you were from if I ever knew, because you have a poem about dragging your brother on the sled through the snow.
And yeah, that was St. Louis.
Yeah, this is not San Antonio.
No, St. Louis.
And where else have you been?
Lived in St. Louis, Jerusalem, and San Antonio.
Hmm.
Three completely different cities.
Very different
about
places.
As different as you can get.
And your husband's a photographer?
Yes, he is.
Does that...
Wonderful photographer.
That's the other side of you. That's the point of view. And you have your other point of view. It's a very nice mesh, I think.
It's a nice compliment. We love to talk about work and questions.
Perspective.
Perspective and the same questions that we ask in different ways in our work. And last year we gave a lecture together. It was lots of fun. We titled it, What Are You Looking For? And we kept going back and forth. But it really was about what are you looking for as an artist in your work? But it was also, as a husband and wife might say, you know, well, what are you looking for? I mean, you've been in the darkroom like weeks now, or you've been in your studio, or you've been wandering in Siberia. What are you looking for? And he might say to me the same thing after I've been, you know, diligently at my desk every day at 4 a.m. Where are you in this book?
Are you still getting up at 4 a.m.?
Yeah, I always do. I like to. It's a
Toynbee
nice time.
Did that. When my children were very small, before they went to school at 7, I would get up at 5, but 4 is a bit much.
Well, 4 gives you that extra hour, you know. I mean, 5 sounds more reasonable. So 4, you need that little edge of irrationality where little kids, when they hear that, will go, oh, how can you stand it? And then you realize, you know, you have this magical time. And there's something about the great quietude, you know, of the city at that hour where there's no sound in the city that is very, very conducive to working.
Does dawn come differently every day?
What do you mean?
Well, you must watch the light. You must watch the sky get light.
Well, often...
So is it different every day?
Well, it's interesting. It is, and of course, it's different hours, but often I'm so deeply working that I'm not paying that much attention to dawn. It's suddenly daylight, and I hadn't even noticed it.
Well, that's interesting. And the opposite can be true. I was coming to Washington on the train today, and I said, I am going to look out this window and not think of anything that's could be a poem. I'm just going to be... Just watch and enjoy this and not try to make everything into a poem. It was the opposite.
Yes.
Taking a vacation
right.
From looking at dawn.
Well, and sometimes that's kind of a cleansing. I mean, you say, okay, no poem now. I just want to be blank, like a blank paper. And then you'll find when you return to poems that you're invigorated toward language. I mean, when you take those little breaks, those pauses.
But then I saw the light start up in the sky.
you didn't do
and
it?
That obsession started.
No.
Yes, we are the Library of Congress. And I'm afraid that I love to hear what you say so much that I'd keep you talking. So I'm going to make myself stop that and listen to poetry, because that's what the world is waiting for.
Well, I'll read two older poems. The Art of Disappearing. When they say, don't I know you? Say, no. When they invite you to the party, remember what parties are like before answering. Someone telling you in a loud voice, they once wrote a poem. Greasy sausage balls on a paper plate. Then reply. If they say, we should get together, say, why? It's not that you don't love them anymore. You're trying to remember something too important to forget. Trees the monastery bell at twilight. Tell them you have a new project. It will never be finished. When someone recognizes you in a grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appears at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. You will never catch up. Walk around feeling like a leaf. Know you could tumble any second. Then decide what to do with your time. Valentine for Ernest Mann. You can't order a poem like you order a taco. Walk up to the counter, say, "I'll take two," and expect it to be handed back to you on a shiny plate. Still, I like your spirit. Anyone who says, "Here's my address, write me a poem," deserves something in reply. So I'll tell a secret instead. Poems hide. In the bottoms of our shoes, they are sleeping. They are the shadows drifting across our ceilings the moment before we wake up. What we have to do is live in a way that lets us find them. Once I knew a man who gave his wife 2 skunks for a Valentine. He couldn't understand why she was crying. I thought they had such beautiful eyes. And he was serious. He was a serious man who lived in a serious way. Nothing was ugly just because the world said so. He really liked those skunks. So he reinvented them as Valentines, and they became beautiful, at least to him. And the poems that had been hiding in the eyes of skunks for centuries crawled out and curled up at his feet. Maybe if we reinvent whatever our lives give us, we find poems. Check your garage, the odd sock in your drawer, the person you almost like, but not quite. And let me know.
And another.
This is called Muchas Gracias por Todo. This plane has landed thanks to God and His mercy. That's what they say in Jordan when a plane sets down. What do they say in our country? Don't stand up till we tell you. Stay in your seats. Things may have shifted. This river has not disappeared thanks to that one big storm when the water was almost finished. We used to say thanks to the springs, but the springs dried up, so we changed it. This rumor tells no truth, thanks to people. This river walk used to be better when no one came. What about the grapes? Thanks to the grapes, we have more than one story to tell. Thanks to a soft place in the middle of the evening. Thanks to 3 secret hours before dawn. These deer are seldom seen because of their shyness. If you see one, you count yourselves among the lucky on the earth. Your eyes get quieter. These deer have nothing to say to us. Thanks to the fan, we are still breathing. Thanks to the small toad that lives in cool mud at the base of the zinnias.
Some poets have kissed you on the cheek along your journey, and I think I remember you saying once William Stafford was important to you.
Very important.
How was that?
Well, I started reading his work when I was 15, and it has been at my heart and soul ever since. The work that I tune to and read, every morning I read it to wake our son up, and I read it all the time to myself.
Did you know him?
Yes, I did. I came to know him and his family. I treasure his wife and his children, the whole family of the Staffords. William Merwin has been a very important poet to me. Lucille Clifton. Recently, I've read Jane Hirschfield often. And Molly Peacock has been a favorite poet. And so many poets from other countries. Nazim Hikmet from Turkey. And Mahmoud Darwish from Palestine. Yehuda Amichai from Israel. So many poets. And,
but reading them and being influenced is not the same thing. So would you be able to say any influences that you feel?
Well, You know, I do think we're influenced by the things which we love passionately, and you feel that, for example, Stafford may be with you in your words, and Merwin may be with you in your silences, and different people are with you in different ways. I think Robert Bly is with me in so many ways in his lilt and his tone, his attitude toward poetry. I mean, Stafford was there right at the heart, and I know that Merwin and Bly feel the same way about Stafford. I mean, he's been that way for so many people, not only in this country, but in other countries too. I've had people in Japan and Pakistan ask me, you know, are there other Americans like him?
Isn't that curious that he did not receive all the biggest prizes? I mean, he didn't get as much official acknowledgement as he did love.
Great
but
love.
Of course, trophies rest in the field, and
that's
I think
right.
He got the good stuff. I don't think he went for self-aggrandizement.
Not at all. He mm-hmm. was possibly the most humble poet mm-hmm. ever and spirit. And so I doubt that he felt a lacking.
When you write for children, how is that different from writing for an adult? And Come With Me should be out.
It is out.
Oh.
I'm very happy it's out. It's illustrated
by
Dan Iacarino. It just came out. I should have brought you one.
Oh, right away.
Yeah.
And how do you see yourself writing those poems in a different way for children?
Well, I think in terms of that book, I was working on poems regarding journeys, all different kinds of journeys, the journey as we grow up, the journey someone else comes into our room and it's as if his own travels come into our room with him, the journey through American history, you know, all kinds of different journeys, our personal journey through time. And so I just found myself writing a long string of many things, you know, 10 times as many as are published in the book, all relating to this kind of come with me idea that we're comrades, we're colleagues on the journey, on the path, and we hearten one another and we learn from one another. And then I ended up with Virginia Duncan, my editor's help, picking the 16 that would go in the book. And, you know, writing for children is not really that different. I mean, maybe you consider your vocabulary in a slightly different way, but if you're a person who loves simpler words anyway, there's not that big of a difference. And, you know, I've always believed that children are capable of much more interpretation and understanding than what we often acknowledge. You know?
Well, didn't you read books when you were small that were on your parents' shelf?
Absolutely.
They were not made for children.
No, absolutely.
And yet we knew what we knew.
That's right.
My daughter reads to her 2-year-old sons in their cribs every night. And she says, what do you think they're getting? And I say, well, I know they're getting the images.
Absolutely.
The narrative, I'm not really sure about.
Oh, they're getting the rhythm of
but
the words.
They
so
listen
much.
To every word, you know, and that is, I know that feather is in their minds, and I know that candle, and I know that,
right.
that imagistically they're getting that.
Oh, that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. That's lovely.
Oh, it is.
I sometimes think it's the greatest poverty not to be read to, you know, of all kinds of poverty. The idea that we don't get to hear voices telling us stories is a very deep and hard to recover from poverty. So I'm really salute all the American libraries that have installed reading programs to children. I know how big that is in San Antonio, children gathering around to hear people read to them, and all the programs on radio now where someone reads something. You know, it's better. I think it's a good time now. With
coming out
a sense
of the station today from the train, there was a homeless man and a homeless woman walking in, and he's saying to her, you got a story? I got a story. We both got a story. Everybody's got a story. And he was welcoming her into the station, I guess, to buy a cup of coffee or something. They had, like, newspapers on their feet. But I thought, how that was so lyrical. You got a story? I got a story. Everybody's got a story.
It's beautiful.
How true.
It's very true.
How true.
How true.
We are at the Library of Congress, and the program is The Poet and the Poem. I think we have time for more. Does that look like a new manuscript?
Well, these are new poems. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't go so far as to say manuscript, but I think I should read Peace because it's for Jerusalem and it has two parts. People pass you in the street and do not see you. Apparition, hidden river, inhabitant of cracks. To billow and breathe without announcement, much preferred. After battering talk, a room clears and you're on the ceiling, extending your silent hand. Water of light, poured freely. A hand, not a flag. You don't believe in flags anymore. You're not even sure you believe in men. But birds, children, silver trays, no problem here. Each day they trade their light and song. They feed you. Rounding the last corner to school, for years and years, a boy touched his finger to the same chipped stone in a wall. Befriending one another was no trouble. The boy knew what came next: tight desk, stretching hours. 60 years later, in another country, he tells one person about the stone, then goes outside to stare into the trees. Is it still there? He will find it. What if it is not there? He will find it. My father told us not long ago about his own precious stone in the old city of Jerusalem, and, you know, all the times we've been there together, he never looked for it with me or showed it to me, and suddenly one day it seemed important to him to talk about, and I think for him that stone signified, you know, something solid, something enduring, his love for that city, even though he would leave it and become an immigrant to the United States, and his own belief that there could be something better for all of the people there.
It's not looking good.
No, it's looking bad. And, you know, the thing that makes me saddest is when I hear a teenager say something hopeless. I heard an Israeli girl recently in San Antonio, you know, make statements to the effect of there will never be peace there. And I don't believe that. No, I believe in this Seeds of Peace project that John Wallach and Bobby Gottschalk have been working with for years that brings Arab and Israeli teens together. I believe in that stuff. You know, I believe that nobody wants to live fighting. Nobody wants to live in this mire of rage and bitterness.
It has to be on the level of children.
Right. Maybe we have to start younger. Maybe that girl was too ruined by anger and hatred already. But no, it has to be started young, and we have to believe in it. But I'm very heartened that elders in my family, my dad and his mother, you know, one of my grandmother's last sentences was, "I never lost my peace inside." And she had been through everything there.
What a line.
So long. Yeah.
What a line.
You know, you may not think we have peace, but some of us never lost our peace inside. And I've always respected those amazing people who try to do their jobs and teach and run groceries and care for their
families.
With
grenades going off in
their
backyard. Yeah,
grenades growing off, being tear gassed while they're there. Yeah, all the time.
Give us something more to go on.
Shoulders. A man crosses the street in rain, stepping gently, looking two times north and south, because his son is asleep on his shoulder. No car must splash him. No car drive too near to his shadow. This man carries the world's most sensitive cargo, but he's not marked. Nowhere does his jacket say, "Fragile, handle with care." His ear fills up with breathing. He hears the hum of a boy's dream deep inside him. We're not going to be able to live in this world if we're not willing to do what he's doing with one another. The road will only be wide. The rain will never stop falling.
The voice of Naomi Shihab Nye. Well, I think at your christening, the good fairy came and said, "You will never be without an idea. That's the gift I'm going to give you. You will grow up and you will never have a 4 o'clock session without a whole basket full of ideas." I don't think you've ever had writer's block.
Grace, that's so dear of you to say.
Well, I don't want to jinx you.
No,
I don't want to even say the word.
No, but what I was going to say is I'm still working up to my christening, because I don't think I was christened or baptized or anything. I wasn't christened because my family was so eclectic. You know, it was sort of as if the rain would christen us, falling on our heads.
Somebody dinged you with a magic wand.
Thank you.
They did.
Well, that's
very sweet
of you.
Because I don't think you've ever not had an idea.
Well, but you know what Stafford used to say about if you're having trouble, lower your standards? I mean, I haven't been that choosy about what I let myself write. You know, when I write in my notebook, I'll write about anything. And so when you are gracious to the experience that is passing through you, when you welcome it, when you say, "Okay, I'm having all these sort of dull thoughts. I'm kind of gloomy. Nothing very sparky has come along today. But here, I'll write this down." And you start writing that down, whatever it is. Then often it becomes the vehicle that carries you to something else. I mean, so many times with so many young writers, all writers of all ages, All you have to do is just open yourself to the experience of the word and have trust that those words will take you somewhere. You know, and also you find these talismans that you read. Like, I know through time, whenever I'm feeling particularly dim-witted, I know that I can read a Charles Simic poem and feel better. I know that. So, of course, I do that. Why wait? I go straight to Charles Simic. I keep him by my desk all the time. And, you know, as we get a little bit older and have more experience, we know what will serve us in that way as readers. We know what lifts our hearts, what challenges us, what makes us think, what makes us laugh. So there. Because I would not let 1 4-year-old son eat frosted mini wheat cereal 15 minutes before dinner, he wrote a giant note and held it up while I talked on the phone. Love has failed. Then he wrote the word love on a paper, stapled it 20 times, and said, I staple you out. Memory stitching its gauze shroud to fit any face. He will say to his friends, she was mean. He will have little interest in diagramming sentences. The boy has good taste. Enormous capacities for high-tech language, but will struggle to bring his lunchbox home. I remember you. You're the one I stared at in the cloud when I wasn't paying attention to people on the ground. The 3-year-old wore 20 dresses to her preschool interview. Her mother could not make her change. Take some off, her mother pleaded, and the girl put on a second pair of tights. Please, I'm begging you, what will they think of us? The girl put all 8 of her pastel barrettes into her hair at once. She put on her fuzzy green gloves. She would have worn 4 shoes, but could not get the second pair on top of the first pair. Her mother cried, "You look like a mountain. Who has come to live with me?" She had trouble walking from the car up to the school, trouble sitting in the small chair that was offered. The headmistress said, "My, my, we are a stubborn personality."
The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest has been Naomi Shihab Nye, the Witter Binner Fellow at the Library of Congress this year. This program has been brought to you by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. We want to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Peter Allier. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. I'm Grace Cavalieri.